Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a PhD holding historian, a professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that makes legit, seriously researched American history come to life through entertaining stories. Join me for a chronological telling of the United States story, from the Revolution to fractious Civil War, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way from 1776 to the early 20th century. Listen to History That Doesn't Suck on Spotify.
On this episode of Most Notorious, the life and times of Calamity Jane.
She used to go to the edge of town when she was in Deadwood in the evenings and crack her bullwhip, and people would sort of gather around her and newcomers would say, "Who is that man with that bullwhip?" And people would go, "That ain't no man, that's Calamity Jane."
Hello, everyone. This is Eric Rivenis, and welcome to another episode of the Most Notorious podcast. Of all of the colorful figures associated with the Old West, Calamity Jane ranks right up there at the top. The story of her relationship with Wild Bill Hickok, especially, has been told and retold with varying degrees of accuracy. Her life was the very definition of embellishment, both through stories told by others about her and stories told by her about her. So let's cut through the fog of history and discover who the real Calamity Jane was. All right, let's begin. So great to have as my guest today, Linda Jacoby. She is a former journalist and a college instructor, and she is also the author of Searching for Calamity, The Life and Times of Calamity Jane. So appreciate you joining me today.
Well, thanks very much.
So what drew you initially to Calamity Jane as the subject of a book?
Well, I've always, even as a little kid, loved the West. I have old photographs of myself from when I was like 4 or 5 years old wearing my Hopalong Cassidy guns. So I've always been drawn to the West. And I have always been drawn to women who didn't have any regard for the rules regarding women. So she was kind of a natural person, you know, for me to take a good look at because she combined all my favorite interests. And actually, I had, like most people, had always heard her name as I was growing up, but I never actually knew that she was a real person. And I was in, I live on the East Coast, but I've always gone out west for vacations. And I was flipping through some postcards in Tombstone, Arizona, outside the OK Corral. And I saw a picture of what looked like what I thought was a young guy. And I turned it over, and it was Calamity Jane. And she sort of captured me at that moment. And that's when I started, you know, really trying to understand her and learn about her life.
There's a lot of mythology around Calamity Jane, much of it perpetuated by the woman herself. Was it difficult in your research to separate fact from fiction?
It was incredibly difficult. I think, you know, anybody writing about the Old West runs into the general problem that there was kind of a complete reality fantasy breakdown there. And at the time, for example, when Deadwood was booming around 1876, there were, you know, lots of made-up stories, you know, coming out of Deadwood. And so even newspaper reports from the time aren't very accurate. And with Calamity in particular, there's a tremendous challenge in trying to sift out what's true, you know, from what the stories are. As you said, she was great at creating stories about herself. I always think of her as, if she were alive now, she would have a YouTube channel. She was, you know, fantastic at self-promotion, and she was illiterate, but she dictated a pamphlet to a PR guy in 1896, what she called her autobiography, when she was getting ready to do a tour of dime museums. And it was something that was pretty common for performers to dictate these, you know, fake autobiographies about themselves. And the stories that she told in there sort of became the stories that people accepted about her as true. So that was one big problem. Another problem was that since she was famous, everybody, you know, wanted to say that they knew her or had memories about her. In many cases, there were people, you know, who had never even met her. So you have to kind of sift that out. Then there were the newspaper reporters who weren't always tied into accuracy about what they said. So that was another challenge. And then there is the additional challenge that as her name became known, other women would use her name. So if a woman was arrested, you know, someplace, let's say in Wyoming, for being drunk and disorderly, she'd be hauled in to the sheriff's office and they'd ask for her name and she'd say it was Calamity Jane. Or there were, for example, a couple of guys in Spokane, Washington, who after Calamity died, gave an interview with the newspaper saying, oh, we remember when she was out here, you know, blah, 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 blah. She was never there. And it could be that they completely made it up, but it's also very likely that there was somebody there who said her name was Calamity Jane, because lots of women said that that was their name. So it was a tremendous challenge, but also, you know, a lot of fun trying to sift out what was accurate. And there are also huge periods of her life where there's absolutely nothing about her, because she spent a lot of her life wandering around through the West, and a newspaper might say Calamity Jane's in town, but apart from that, you know, there was, you know, nothing. So yeah, it's that was definitely the big, you know, the big challenge.
What was Calamity Jane's real name? When and where was she born?
Her name was Martha Canary. She was actually born in Princeton, Missouri, probably in 1852. She says she was born in 1852. There's information in 1864 where somebody identifies her as being 12, but there's some conflicting information, but it was around 1852. So she was born in Princeton, and she had... Her father was a farmer, and her mother was sort of a ne'er-do-well, had a reputation as a ne'er-do-well, and was an alcoholic, as Calamity also became. And she had at least one sister and one brother. She says she had five siblings, and it's possible that the other three, you know, died in childhood, because that was, you know, quite common. And then in 1864, her family left and migrated west on the Oregon Trail and ended up in Virginia City, Montana. And that's how she made it to the West. And according to her, that was the first big adventure in her life, taking the Oregon Trail.
So life was hard for her, of course, growing up.
It was extremely hard. One of the things that I admire about Calamity is she could take the hardness of her life and make it feel like an adventure. So she'll if you read Oregon Trail journals, written by women who kept them at the time as they were traveling west, the trip was awful. The weather, the rain, the sleet, slogging through mud, getting across streams and rivers, foraging for fuel to cook. There was so much illness. But for Calamity, as she writes about it, and I think as she felt about it, it was an incredible adventure, going out hunting, getting across the rivers, lowering the covered wagons down over sides of cliffs. But it was extremely hard. And then her mother died the next year. And actually, there's an article in a Virginia City, Montana newspaper from 1864, the year her family arrived there, talking about three little girls who were going door to door or tent to tent, begging food, and they said their name was Canary, and the oldest one was 12, which would have been Calamity. So you can get a sense from that how desperate she was as a child. Her mother died the next year, and her father took her and her two siblings to Salt Lake City, and then he died 2 years later. So by the time she was 15, she was on her own and briefly responsible for her two siblings. She apparently left them with family somewhere and took off to the West. And that was what her whole life was like, really, just kind of wandering and surviving, except for her few moments of glory as a Western character.
Much of her mythology is based on her dressing like a man, acting like a man. What is the first account of her dressing like that? Was there a particular moment when this identity was solidified?
Well, by the time she came to Deadwood on July 15, 1876, when she was 24, she was already a famous character because she actually... I'll get back to that story, but when she arrived in Deadwood, the Deadwood newspaper had a headline, Calamity Jane Has Arrived. So she was known by then by her name. The year previously, she had actually been with the Jenny expedition that had been sent by the federal government to figure out how much gold was in the Black Hills and to also start mapping the Black Hills, because the Black Hills are actually part of Sioux territory. The United States had given the land to the Sioux in the Treaty of Fort Laramie in 1868, but of course now that gold was discovered, they were, eager to take the land back. And the government had sent the Jenny expedition out there, and Calamity actually joined up as a mule driver carrying supplies, so she had to have been dressed as a man then, looked like a man, because women weren't allowed, they weren't allowed to join the army, obviously, and they weren't allowed to participate in any way in that kind of endeavor. And there's actually a photograph of her from 1875 with the Jenny expedition, and she's resting against a rock and looks like a man. So, definitely by then, but that's the earliest that it's possible to say for sure that she was passing as a man, because there's just not earlier information. But she does say in her autobiography, true or not, that when she was on the Oregon Trail, she always spent her time with the men, hunting. So, probably even then, if you were a female at that time and your choice was between being a woman or being a man when you grew up, there wasn't much of an option, because men had opportunity and freedom, and women were pretty confined. And I give her a lot of credit for, you know, recognizing that early on and doing it, you know. But you can't say for sure before 1875 because there's just, you know, nothing there.
She didn't try to hide the fact that she was a woman, though, right? She went by the name Jane.
Well, for the couple of times when she was associated with the military, whether it was with the Jenny expedition or later when she was driving a mule wagon with supplies for General Crook in 1876, she had to pass as a man because she would have been, you know, kicked off. But she didn't go to any lengths to hide, you know, to hide the fact that, you know, that she was a woman. And everybody around her knew that she was. They just didn't want, you know, the people with authority to know that she was. So no, she never, for example, there were women soldiers in the Civil War, and they had to go to great lengths to disguise the fact that they were women, you know, so they wouldn't get kicked out of the army. And they would, you know, dress in private. They would never go to military doctors. And Calamity never did anything like that because she didn't, you know, she just didn't care. So, yeah, she didn't go to any lengths to hide the fact that she was a woman. And apart from those two instances, she was just, you know, who she was. But you look at photographs of her and a number of her, she loved having her photograph taken, and she would, you know, go to photographic studios and get costumed up. And in some of them, she's costumed as a woman. But in many of them, you know, she looks like a male gunfighter or a male scout. But no, she didn't care. She was just who she was.
I know there is some debate on how she got her nickname, Calamity Jane.
Right.
Can you tell us what you believe is the origin of that name?
She says that she got her name from a Colonel Egan when she rescued him in an Indian battle. And that's completely fabricated. And there's a lot of debate about whether, you know, she got her name because she caused people to fall into calamity or because she rescued them from calamity. And my own opinion is it was kind of a combination of both. But apart from that one story about her rescuing Egan and him, you know, naming her Calamity Jane because she had saved him from calamity, there aren't specific stories about how she got the name. Now, of course, I mean, everybody in the West had nicknames, you know, Wild Bill Hickok. And it's one of the things that I think everybody would love to know, like, where did that name come from? But it's, I think, one of the many things about her, you know, that will forever remain unknown for sure. But it is the perfect name for her. She definitely, you know, wouldn't be famous with a different kind of nickname.
I think probably for most of us, we know Calamity Jane from the HBO series Deadwood.
Right.
That's my guess. In that show, we are led to believe that she and Wild Bill Hickok were friends, close friends. But history shows something different. Would you tell us about the real story behind how they met and what their relationship really was?
Absolutely. Wild Bill Hickok was coming to Deadwood in the summer of 1876. He had recently gotten married, and he had married a woman who had been previously married and had owned a circus with her husband, and her husband died. And she wanted to go on performing and owning the circus, but Wild Bill Hickok had said to her, "No, you know, I just want you to, you know, be my wife and I'll, you know, take care of you." So he loved to gamble, and he went with a small group of people and to head for Deadwood. And when he got to Fort Laramie in Wyoming on the way, the people at the fort told him two things. One was you have to get together a group of about 100 people to go because the Indians were attacking smaller groups. And the second thing was we have this woman in the guardhouse who was arrested for being drunk and disorderly, and get her off our hands and take her with you. And that was Calamity Jane. So that's how they met. Hickok and his friends, you know, got her from the guardhouse, and she rode with them and the rest of the group. They got together to Deadwood. And I consider that actually the luckiest moment of Calamity's life, because without Deadwood, she would never have become, you know, this sort of eternal myth that she's, you know, that she has become. So she was with him on the trip to Deadwood, and he apparently didn't pay much attention to her. He wasn't a big talker to start with anyway, and he liked to drink a lot. And he'd get up in the morning and drink and then do some target practice and then go off continuing their trip. But she always, you know, had a thing about him and, you know, thought he was extremely dashing. So they knew each other for the trip there, which lasted a couple of weeks. But they definitely, you know, weren't close, although she was apparently a big hit on the trip because people love to sit around the campfire at night and listen to her tell stories. And then when they got to Deadwood, Hickok and this group that he was with set up camp outside of town, and Calamity went into town and got a room somewhere, but would go back to the camp and, you know, kind of hung around with Hickok, but he never paid her much attention. Then just about two weeks after they arrived, he arrived in Deadwood on August 2nd, 1876. He was killed at Saloon number 10. And Calamity claims that when he was shot, she was in town and she went, you know, rushing out of her room when she heard he was shot, and cornered the assassin in a butcher shop and picked up a big butcher knife, you know, and held him, and, you know, until he was taken away, which is not true. Jack McCall was captured in a butcher shop, but Calamity was nowhere around. So it was Calamity who created the story about her and Hickok. And supposedly, and I kind of actually believe this, at his funeral, she picked up a small wildflower that was growing and tossed it, you know, into his grave, which was kind of a nice moment. And within less than 2 years, there was a melodrama being performed in various theaters around the country, on stage around the country, called A Drama of Life in the Black Hills. And it includes a scene of when Hickok is shot and Calamity comes running into the saloon and kneels over his body, you know, weeping and professing her love for him. So the myth just got out there all over the country, you know, immediately. And she always played on it. She had the last photograph she ever had taken in her life, which was a couple of weeks before she died. She was standing in front of Hickok's grave at Mount Moriah Cemetery in Deadwood, you know, holding a flower. And it's certainly, you know, it's a myth that has persisted. I don't know if you ever saw the old Doris Day movie, Calamity Jane, from the 1940s, but the movie is so much about Calamity Jane's love for Wild Bill Hickok. And there's a scene in the movie where Doris Day transforms from being the male Calamity into a female Calamity and becomes very feminine, which she does, you know, she does for Hickok, you know, so he'll be as attracted to her as she is to him. So it's, you know, it's one of these just incredible. In 1941, on Mother's Day, a woman named Jean Hickok, and I can't, McCormick, went on a radio show and said she was the daughter of Wild Bill Hickok and Calamity Jane, and started reading from these letters that she sent, said that Calamity had written her towards the end of Calamity's life, talking about how much she missed her and she regretted having given her away, you know, in adoption when she was a baby. Well, of course, Calamity, you know, was illiterate and couldn't possibly have written these letters. And it turned out that this woman, Jean McCormick, was born 10 years after Wild Bill Hickok died. But it just shows the persistence of the myth, you know, in people's minds. And it was something that, you know, that Calamity created and everybody picked up on. So it's kind of a great story, even though it's completely untrue.
But she was near Hickok. She did join the search for Jack McCall. There was a foundation for her stories.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she did. She obviously had, you know, a huge attraction to him. And I don't think he would, you know, he didn't give her the time of day. But she did have an enormous attraction to him, and she was there when he was killed. And she did accompany him on the trip from Fort Laramie, you know, to Deadwood. So it's not, they were in the same place at the same time.
Right, right. So she's 24 years old, and she suddenly becomes a celebrity after this. Melodramas are performed about her, like you said, with her as a character. What does she do with this? Was she able to capitalize on her newfound fame?
Well, she didn't start really capitalizing on it until 1896. She stayed in Deadwood for a couple of years when she first came in 1876. And then, you know, she just wandered through the West and, you know, she did work as a bullwhacker part of the time, and then she did things like, you know, had a laundry, or she would have a roadside house where people would stay. I think she probably occasionally worked as a prostitute, but mostly she just went from, you know, town to town, picking up odd jobs, drinking. But in 1895, she, I think, realized that so many people, so many of the characters from the Old West were making money because they were characters from the Old West. I mean, the Old West was essentially gone by then, but she went to a portrait studio in Montana in 1895 and had a photograph taken of her, you know, dressed in buckskins and, you know, looking like a man. And she started selling her photograph. And that was, or she'd sell her photograph or barter it for drinks, and started making money from her fame. And she went back to Deadwood, and somebody from the Cole and Middleton Dime Museums, which were dime museums, were museums with all kinds of odd exhibits in them. But somebody from a string of museums owned by these two guys, Cole and Middleton, came out there and signed her to a contract to appear in four museums in 1896 in Minneapolis, Chicago, Philadelphia, and New York. And that's when she dictated her autobiography to this guy, who I'm sure also, you know, embellished it on top of her dictation. And she really got prepared, you know, for her performance, got new clothes, bought new boots, which she apparently never paid for, went out and practiced shooting, even though she was just going to be up on stage, and really learned to recite her autobiography pretty much by heart. And so that's when she did her first real on-stage performances. She took the train to Minneapolis in 1896 and appeared on stage and was apparently fairly drunk a lot of the time, and then went to Chicago and probably performed there also. And after that, There's no record of what happened, but most likely she never showed up in Philadelphia or New York because there's absolutely no advertisements from the Times, from that period, no reporting on it, and gradually started to make her way back west. So she was kind of, a failure on the big stage. But what she learned from that was that she could support herself by selling her story. So she started going through the West, selling her autobiographical pamphlet and selling photographs of herself. And her favorite place to go was to Yellowstone National Park. And there's an incredible photograph of her taken by this man named Burton Holmes in 1896 of Calamity standing outside this big tent, which was actually a restaurant in the park in 1896, wearing this long dress, holding her pamphlets and her photographs, talking to a man and a little kid. And it is the most wonderful photograph of her. She's smiling. She looks at, at ease, which she usually doesn't in her photographs. But that's how she supported herself for the remainder of her life. Selling her picture, selling her photographs, and selling her autobiographical pamphlet.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor.
The storm broke in Chattanooga one night in 1906, when a young woman was the victim of a violent crime. From that moment, the city knew no peace for four furious years. At the center of the storm was the notorious inmate, Dave Edwards, who was awaiting trial on murder charges. After a high-profile case threatened to go cold, the desperate county sheriff did the unthinkable by freeing Dave Edwards from jail and deputizing him to track down the fugitive. Grievous Deeds, 4 Years of Fury in Chattanooga, Tennessee, written by Kimberly Tilly, narrated by Samuel Burst, is the most amazing true crime story you've never heard. Listen to Grievous Deeds, the audiobook, available on Audible, iTunes, and Amazon.
Hi. I'm Matt Albers, host of the Pirate History Podcast. The men and women of the Golden Age of Piracy are some of the most infamous and often misunderstood characters in all of human history. You know their names. Captain Morgan, Anne Bonny, Henry Avery, Mary Read, Captain Kidd, Blackbeard. But do you know their stories, their real stories? Every week over on the Pirate History Podcast, we explore the real lives of these pirates. We examine what made these pirates sail the high seas in search of plunder and adventure and revenge. The real stories are a lot more complex and a lot more interesting than the stories most of us have been told. If you'd like to hear the stories of the real men and women who went on the account and sailed under the black flag, join us on the Pirate History Podcast.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
And now back to the show. What were some of the more outrageous stories that she claimed really happened?
there are many. There are stories about her. She likes to talk about when she rescued the Deadwood stagecoach that had been attacked by Indians. And the Indians had killed the driver. And for some reason, I don't know where she appeared from because she never quite says, but she, leaped onto the driver's seat in the stagecoach, and there were 7 passengers inside, and she raced away and, you know, and brought it to safety. So that's a fabulous story, and I think Buffalo Bill Cody sort of repeated it in his Wild West show. And then there's, you know, lots of stories about her fighting the Indians, you know, going with Custer to Arizona. She never was in Arizona, and fighting the Indians there, and fighting with General Crook. She was, and racing 90 miles with important messages from General Crook, you know, to take back to the fort, and swimming across this a raging river, you know, carrying these dispatches, and being cold and wet and sick when she arrived at the fort with essential messages. So she loved to aggrandize herself in those ways. They're great. They are great stories. Calamity, the West was so full of adventure, you know, back in the 1870s, and she just always would place herself in the middle of the events. I'm surprised that she's never described herself as the sole survivor of Custer's last stand.
Right. She was pretty handy with a bullwhip, wasn't she?
She was a fantastic bullwhacker, and it is a great art. If you've ever seen a bullwhip, they're like 16 feet long, and she was good. And there's stories about her, which I actually believe, because they're told by enough different people, of her bullwhacking skill. She used to go to the edge of town when she was in Deadwood in the evenings and crack her bullwhip, and people would sort of gather around her, and newcomers would say, "Who is that man with that bullwhip?" And people would go, "That ain't no man. That's Calamity Jane." And there's a story that I love about some bullwhacker. And, you know, bulls were enormous. There was a bullwhacker whose bull team and wagon got stuck in the mud, you know, on Main Street in Deadwood, which was, you know, just a bunch of mud, and he couldn't get them to move. And Calamity made a bet with the guy that, you know, she could get the bulls to start moving and, you know, pull the wagons out of the mud. So he agreed, and she, you know, got into the driver's seat, you know, picked up the bullwhip, and, you know, within 2 minutes, had them, you know, pulling the wagon out of the mud. She was a great bullwhacker. She was also a good shot.
Well, speaking of good shots, Annie Oakley and Buffalo Bill Cody, what were her relationships, if any, with them?
Okay. Calamity was, I think she would have loved to, she wouldn't have loved to perform in actuality with the Wild West show, but she loved the concept of it. But she didn't like any form of discipline, you know, or being told what to do and when to do it. So she never performed with the show, and there were rumors about her performing or supposed to be performing but never actually doing it with lesser Wild West shows. But Cody, you know, claimed that he was a friend of hers. She was back east in 1901 at the Pan American Exposition in Buffalo briefly, just for a few weeks, and left and didn't have enough money to get all the way, you know, back west. And Cody claims that he gave her the money when he came out to the Pan American Exposition, gave her the money for her train ticket to get back west. So Cody, you know, wanted his name attached to hers. But beyond that, I don't think they had, you know, any relationship. He liked the sense of being her benefactor. But she was, a very different kind of person than Annie Oakley, who was, you know, extremely self-disciplined, actually not Western at all. She was from east of the Mississippi. And Annie Oakley was always, her entire life, tried to present this sort of, you know, little girl image. But they never met. I enjoy imagining them meeting, but they never did actually meet.
One of the things that the Deadwood television show seemed to have gotten right was its portrayal of Calamity Jane as an alcoholic. She liked to drink, and she drank a lot.
She was an incredible drinker. As I said, her mother was an alcoholic, and she was, you know, definitely an alcoholic. And I think one of the things that killed her was cirrhosis, because she had a lot of symptoms of it. And she was noted for her drinking. There was a saloon in Wyoming that, in a town where she hung around for a few months, that started calling whiskey Calamity Water, because she was so noted, you know, for coming in and drinking whiskey. And later in her life, she just rode the trains all the time. And she'd get off, go into a town, go to a bar and drink. She was famous for howling like a coyote when she was drunk. She was arrested and spent a lot of nights in jail for drinking. I mean, she was a really serious drinker. I mean, when she went to Cary, South Dakota, when she was dying, and she knew she was going there to die, she got off the train there, and the first thing she did was go into a saloon and start drinking. But then she got so sick, they had to carry her out and take her to a hotel. I mean, drinking was, you know, quite popular in the West at that time, especially. But she drank constantly.
You said she was 52 when she died?
She was probably 52. She died on August 1st, 1903. So if she was actually born in 1852, when she said she was, yeah, she was only 52 years old. And she'd been pretty sick, or quite sick, the last couple of years of her life. She was actually on a train in Montana 2 years earlier and got so sick. People helped her off the train, and she was taken to what was known as a poor farm, which was a place where people who were destitute went, basically to die. But she left 3 days later because she couldn't stand it there, and hung on for a couple more years. She was just 52 years old.
She was buried next to Wild Bill Hickok, right?
She was. And if you go to Mount Moriah Cemetery, it's wonderful because you can stand in front of her grave and of Wild Bill. And there are two stories about why she was buried there. One is that on her deathbed, she asked to be buried next to Wild Bill, which could very well be true. And the other is that her funeral arrangements were taken care of by a group in Deadwood that were people who had, been there in 1876 and 1877 when it was, the place to be if you were looking, to get rich. And the other story is that it was their idea to bury her by Wild Bill. Her cemetery plot is wonderful. So, yes, she is buried next to him, which I think would have made her very happy. I will say that Hickok's family never really approved of the association of him with Calamity Jane. And in the early 20th century, when this movie, The Plainsman, was being made, and it was going to feature the imagined romance between Wild Bill and Calamity, they wrote to the director, and expressed their fury that their ancestor would be associated, with this disreputable woman.
Don't some people believe that part of the reason she was buried next to him, it was kind of a practical joke? Poor Wild Bill wanted nothing to do with her when he was alive, and now he's forced to spend eternity next to her.
It's a great story, isn't it? I would say at this point in history, she's probably the dominant figure in their relationship too, I think it's one of the great ironies.
Did she ever get married? Did she ever have children?
Well, that's another good question. She certainly, you know, took up with various men that she would stay with, you know, anywhere from a couple of months to, you know, off and on for a couple of years. And she always referred to them as her husband. But most probably, she never married any of them. It was very common at the time for women to refer to men as their husbands when they were what we would now call, you know, their partners. So it's questionable whether she was ever, you know, legally married. And there were, you know, four or five men that she took up with for a while. One of them was actually an abuser, this guy William Steers, who she actually, you know, called the sheriff's office or went to the sheriff's office for a couple of times. One time he tried to stab her, and then another time he tried to, like, beat her up with a wrench. And it's also questionable whether she had any children. When she came back to Deadwood at the end of 1895, she took the train in, and she was with a nine-year-old girl named Jessie, who she, you know, referred to as her daughter. So it may have been her daughter. She brought her, actually, she was going to put her, wanted to enroll her in a school in a nearby town in Sturgis. So it might have been her daughter, but there's no mention of her ever having a daughter, although there's one vague mention of her once having a son who never, you know, has never appeared in anything. But it was also fairly common then for people to sort of unofficially adopt other people's children. It was like when Calamity, you know, left Salt Lake City when she was 15, and she had a younger brother and younger sister, and they were left, you know, somewhere with some other family in Wyoming. So this, you know, it might have been her daughter, or it might have been somebody who she was taking care of, who she referred to as her daughter. So it's another one of those things that there's absolutely, you know, there's no way of knowing. And there were no birth certificates, you know, back then. So there's no official records of anything. And she did pick up Jessie at some point a couple years later and went off with her and then was never seen with her again. So she probably left her with another woman or another family. So it's just, you know, it's, I don't think anybody's ever come forward and said that they were Calamity Jane's daughter. Although, actually, I wouldn't bet on that because people will say anything.
Except for that one woman in the 40s, right?
Right. Who said she was, yeah, Hickok and Calamity Jane's daughter. Although she would have been, you know, way too old to be Jessie in 1895, because she said she says she was born, you know, in 77, shortly after, you know, months after Hickok was killed. So yeah, it's another one of those mysteries that will never be solved.
Right. So there have been so many portrayals of Calamity Jane in television and film. Are there any that particularly stand out for you, either for their ridiculousness or their historical accuracy?
Well, I have to say that I enjoyed them all, with the possible exception of Jane Russell, who was, I don't know if you've ever saw her. She's this quite, you know, buxom, sex symbol kind of woman. But the person who I actually most like as Calamity Jane is Angelica Houston in the movie Buffalo Girls, because she's so serious and tough. And I think the toughness is what's missing in a lot of portrayals, because Calamity, you know, had a lot of problems, you know, including her alcoholism, most of all. But she was, above all things, you know, tough. So I especially like the Angelica Houston portrayal. But there have been just almost constant portrayals of Calamity since 1878. So she's kind of amazing how she's held on, you know, in the public imagination.
So for people who want to learn more about you, learn about your book, where can we direct them?
I would go to the Amazon website, and you can go to stampedebooks.com or searchingforcalamity.com.
Perfect. Well, this has been just great. Thank you for your time today.
Fantastic. Did I do okay?
Yes, absolutely. You did great. Again, I've been speaking to Linda Jacoby. She is the author of Searching for Calamity, The Life and Times of Calamity Jane. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.
All you need is a few minutes to start your day off with something historic when you listen to the This Day in History podcast. Every day, there's a new episode for you to listen and learn about what happened that day way back when. So listen and subscribe to This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts. That's This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts.